You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm Kat Rosenfield.
I'm Phoebe Maltz-Bovey. This is Feminine Chaos.
On Blogging Heads.
Oh my goodness.
A while since we were on Zoom together.
Yeah, and this has been, how do we even say?
It's been a journey, and we're coming to the end of this journey here on Blogging Heads.
Not of all journeys. Journeys continue, but this particular branch of journey does not.
Yes, it's been exactly 2 years since we launched this podcast.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay.
Which I, you know, it's funny to me because I think at the time that we did it, we sort of didn't really know what we were doing or what was going to happen with, you know, with this. And, And now 2 years later, we are, still continuing to podcast, but we have decided for a variety of reasons, including the fact that it's difficult in small homes, with spouses and pandemic to find time to video cast. Mm-hmm. We're going to take the podcast to an audio only format. If you already subscribed to Feminine Chaos on another podcasting service, you will be automatically kicked over to our new feed. You won't have to do anything. And we're figuring that out with the Blogging Heads folks, and we appreciate their help on this front. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, we'll be audio only. We still have our Patreon where we post exclusive episodes for subscribers. We urge you to visit it at Feminine Chaos. Patreon.com/feminine chaos. And I think is that all the housekeeping? Did I miss anything?
I think so. I mean, yeah, it's been fun to be associated with, Blogging Heads because, you know, it's like, as you would read in, Megan Dalm's book, like it's a whole institution. I feel like now we are ready to spread our wings like the peacocks behind you and show all of our many colorful colors.
Show our tail feathers, even though it's the male peacocks that are the colorful ones.
I know. This is like one of the few things you can do here is go to this zoo that is now closed actually because of the pandemic, but it has peacocks.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
Well, so, in honor of our final Blogging Heads conversation, the cat, Rasputin, has joined us, so we'll let him say hello. If you hear purring, this is why.
Oh, a little licking.
He's a really licky cat. I don't know if our viewers have picked up on how often I spend these conversations with my hands in my lap, just letting the cat go to town on them, you know, trying to pretend that it doesn't bother me, but I actually really hate it.
So what are our topics for today?
Today we're talking
you coined a very good expression, and I think you have to say it because it's amazing.
The Madonna Karen complex.
Yes.
You know, the new dichotomy that has emerged over the course of certainly the past year, if not the past four. And we're going to be, I think this is a good note to go out on. This is really in line with our previous, sort of like our entire oeuvre of conversations. Phoebe, which of these elements of said complex do we want to talk about first?
I think we better talk about white women vote Republican, get used to it, Democrats, which is Liz Lenz's notorious, much celebrated, much despised, whatever. I've actually not much been looking at the replies to it, but Washington Post column about the white ladies. Now, I'm just going to say, there seems to be like this kind of template article. I literally wrote about this, not to be all like, I wrote a book, but I did write a book a while ago. It came out in 2017, but I wrote it before, it's called The Perils of Privilege. I wrote it before Trump was even the nominee, except for the afterword, after it was the nominee. This was already a thing then. These articles, these templates have been floating around for a really long time. There's also a Catherine McKinnon, the classic feminist Catherine McKinnon article from, I think, possibly the 90s that kind of makes a lot of these points. This is not new. Basically, there's this like template white ladies article that just exists in the world. So she wrote, Catherine McKinnon, wrote an article about this way of thinking. This was not such an article of hers. But anyway,
You wrote a whole book women. About it. And yet, despite the fact that you wrote a whole book about this, people are still trotting out this template as though it makes any sense at all.
Well, so basically, it's just this notion that white women think they're all victims of sexism, but actually they are the oppressors in terms of racism, as versus people having different facets of their identity and all of this. It becomes like, it's one or the other. It becomes in the discourse that either white women are the oppressor or white women are the oppressed. And the idea that people could be different things in different contexts and could also have aspects of their selves that aren't to do with whiteness or womanhood, impossible. But anyway, so this article, I should just sort of, it includes the phrase, and I think this is really important and I want to dwell on this, suburban wine moms.
Oh, it does do that. You know, it's funny. I just want to say that I feel at this point like I could write one of these articles in my sleep.
Likewise.
And, you know, and maybe we both should, because it seems like there's no shortage of homes for this take just to keep being published over.
Oh, no, absolutely. So it keeps being, it's the same article again and again. And basically it says that, you know, it cites the exit polls with the 53%. From 2016, where 53% of white women voted for Trump, which turned out not to be the case. It also turned out to be that this was only white women voters being looked at, not that 53% of white women.
There's also always the now this nod. They'll say, well, it turned out that wasn't true, but might
let's
as
just,
well
let's
have
just
been
continue.
True.
Exactly. So that's, so there's always about the 53%. There's always about the sort of cringe, performative, pussy hat, pro Hillary Clinton, insufficiently whatever, you know, the women who vote Democrat but are not like young, hip, and living in Bushwick or something, you know, that great crime that exists.
I thought the whole point was that they, you know, they don't vote Democrat because white women, as a monolith, there are millions of them, and yet
they
universally vote to uphold white supremacy and to make themselves adjacent to the power of the white cis hetero patriarchy.
Oh yes.
Rather than expressing solidarity with women who include non-white women. I'm just, you know, this is the article that I'm going to write in my sleep tonight.
Oh yeah, no, I think we should definitely tonight. I definitely plan on doing this in my sleep. So the one that we're talking about though includes a few really, really amazing passages that, it's just the same thing. It's just the same thing. And what bothers me just on like from a literary perspective is how can the same thing keep appearing? Like how can the same article keep appearing? And who is eating this up? Because people are. And it's like, it's inaccurate.
I think I know who's eating it up.
Is it Rasputin?
Well, no. I'm sure he loves it.
I mean, my dog would eat up just about anything.
Yes, you could print this article out, and if you dribbled a little bit of meat juice on it, the dogs, I think, both would eat the paper pretty happily. Mm-hmm. But, you know, who's eating it up, I'm sure, is the same subset of extremely guilty white women who are writing these articles. It's like they write them and then they read them and then they write more of them.
So I think there's more than, I think that's definitely, I'm going to yes and this theory and say that I think it's also men, not just white men, but not white men, who are, you know, enjoying the opportunity to be like, yuck women, yuck older women, yuck women I don't want to sleep with because they're old and suburban and drinking wine, you know, to get away from their teenagers. And maybe the teenage girls would be interesting, but their moms are probably old and uninteresting and suburban and definitely voted for Trump. And that's why I don't like them. And it's not because they aren't nubile and in bikinis and offering themselves to me. So I think there are some men also. I do think I agree with you though that it's mostly women, but I want to do a few quotes.
Yes, please.
Because I just, while prepping for this, apart from putting on eyeliner for the first time in a very long time. Okay, so first, okay. To many white women, equality means dominating the system like men rather than dismantling it to make it fair for everyone. Okay, so that's a fairly short quote, but I think it packs a lot in there. So first up, who are these people, these saintly imagined people who are not white women and who do not want the best for themselves or and their loved ones, but who are just all for dismantling systems out of the goodness of their hearts and who do not simply want to be the more powerful in whichever existing systems? Is this some kind of phenomenon? No, most people want the best for themselves. This is not a white women thing. This is a thing. It's a human thing, mm-hmm. I'm going to just say. So this that just already like really kind of got to me. But then, okay, so this is the sort of template part. In pink, quote, pussy hats, they protested the inauguration of a president accused of sexual assault whose misogyny had become a feature of his campaign. This was the rage of women, a force that, we were told, would be a cleansing power in U.S. politics. Hillary Clinton's loss would be the catalyst for a new era of empowered womanhood. So this, I think, gets at a little bit of like the baseline issue here, which is that women, on the whole, were sort of set up to be, and this then Me Too really sort of reinforced this a lot, but this notion of like women are the victims, women are going to save us all, got very sort of like, there was this kind of like mainstream liberal thing about this and mainstream progressive thing about this.
Oh yeah. I mean, Rebecca Traister wrote a whole book about how women's rage was going to drive like the greatest political evolution/revolution that we'd ever seen.
Right.
That was not that long ago.
Right. There was this whole sort of, there were like, I think a few books about the anger, how women's anger was this wonderful force, which seems to have not unfairly led to a backlash, but like, again, an overshooting the mark backlash. So instead of it being that women are angry for all sorts of reasons, some of which have to do with making the world a fairer place, others of which do not. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's become like, actually, white women are white supremacists, all of them, especially the ones who bought white fragility, which we will talk about. But so I think that there is like something, there is something to this where like these forces, is this dialectical? I never know how to use dialectical in a way.
I don't even know what that word means. Oh,
I
no.
guess, okay, we're gonna start. Okay. There are these two things that require each other. And one of them is this notion of women as ultimate victims. And the other is this notion of that actually all women who are privileged by any, according to any axis, are actually the very, very worst, worse even than men. So, or than the men and their equivalent, whatever. But,
So can I just say, or did you want to quote more?
Because I do want to quote more, but well, there's just one more that relates to this, and then the other part doesn't relate. So this is, okay, it's the logic of claiming to be a loser while winning. So that's a little reference to Trump there, I guess. Of course, all women, conservative and liberal, at all levels of society, face real discrimination and sexism. But that makes donning the mantle of victimhood while perpetuating the patriarchy an even more cynical game. So it's like, women are actually victims of sexism, and Lenz doesn't want to deny that, but she also wants to have this kind of like sift out this category of like the Trump supporting women who are somehow like, it doesn't count for them. They are not, they are just assholes basically.
Right, right. Donning the, you know, they're, when they claim to have experienced sexism or what have you, that it's really just
it's manipulative.
A cynical and manipulative way of making themselves adjacent to power, which of course nobody who didn't vote for Trump would ever do. We certainly have seen absolutely no cynical and opportunistic claims to victimhood happening, except in Trump voting camp over the past 4 years. I'm just in case anybody didn't realize I'm being sarcastic. I was just thinking about like the inevitable anger in the comments over when similar to when you read something aloud that people then think is actually your point of view.
Oh, should I explain that? So yeah, just so you know, I did not write that article.
You are not Liz Lenz.
No.
But so yeah, there was something about to return actually to the first thing that you mentioned, where it was this sort of outrage over the fact that women rather than, you know, engaging in this sort of saint-like attempt to promote equality across the board and level the playing field for all, actually want political power for the sake of having political power and, you know, bettering their own lot in life. I think that the expectation there that women particularly would do the other thing has a lot to do with the fact that there's been, you know, even now, even, you know, as we're supposed to be sort of like post-gendered expectations, there is still this notion in the air that women are supposed to be nurturing. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be selfless. They're supposed to be, you know, if you're a woman, you're supposed to be like the world's mom, basically. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this expectation. The world's wine mom. This expectation of care, you know, mm-hmm. from whomever. And we've seen it directed not just at women politicians or women activists, but also like women entrepreneurs, you know, mm-hmm. where it's like your brand is not adequately caring of
me. the girl bosses.
Your brand doesn't make me feel loved and validated. And it's like, you know.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I'm going to have to skip ahead to a quote from an article that we are going to talk about later in this show, just because it's so apropos and we will contextualize it later. But listen, here's a quote and you will learn later what it's from. According to another anonymous source, a white woman who owns a popular bookstore on the East Coast was accused of being performative by an employee. Accused of being performative.
Well.
I just love that line, and I just wanted to make sure that that was out in the world.
It's so good. It encompasses so much.
I think that's just like, yeah, yeah. I mean, just like what you're saying, like this whole... there just seems to be this baseline idea in society of women as ridiculous that seems to kind of like, I mean, the obvious way of talking about this is like left misogyny. That's what it's often referred to as. But just this idea of women as sort of like inherently just sort of having less going on, like maybe being kind of selfish and grasping and gold digging or whatever, but not having any sort of like complexity, which actually brings up my final quote from this article that I'm going to have to read. Again, I did not write this article. I'm quoting from it, okay? White women voting Republican isn't remarkable. What is remarkable is the amount of money and effort that went to flip suburban women, okay, who are being here conflated with white women, anyway, who had no intention of voting Democratic at all, because remember, there's only one woman, so that's my side, okay, who had no intention of voting Democratic at all, while other groups of voters were taken for granted. Trump made gains in 2020 among Black voters and Latino voters, two subsets of voters long considered a monolith, but who are far more complex and multifaceted than any party gives them credit for, and who demonstrated independent thinking that went against predicted behavior. I mean, I was so overwhelmed by the article that, like, this, I hadn't even, like, paid much attention to that passage, but then somebody, like, highlighted it on Twitter and was, when I tweeted out about the article and was like, look at this, and I was like, oh my goodness.
That's
so
incredible.
Like you're complex if there's at least a possibility that you're a man and you
yes.
have complicated reasons because
that's
this,
an interesting way to put it. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, then you might have really like, you might be for Trump, but you have a reason. You have a good reason. But if you're vapid white lady sipping from one of those, you know, those glasses that hold a whole bottle of wine, you're that.
I don't own one, but I have seen them. Yeah.
I saw them. I'm not, oh my God, this is going to be too ridiculous. I think I saw one either to be given away or for sale on a local mom's Facebook group.
Oh.
But it's like a gag gift. I mean, I don't think people are actually.
It is.
Anyway.
It makes me think of, okay, that is absolutely enough. Sorry. Oh, and he just unplugged my light. Comedy of errors here. I guess this is how we're going to go out. what were we talking about? Oh yeah, giant wines as wine glasses as gag gifts. Well, you know, that just makes me think of the fact that I think the most famous use of an oversized wine glass is Amy Schumer, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. in her Friday Night Lights spoof skit where she keeps drinking out of an increasingly huge glass of wine until we're not even talking about one that holds like an entire bottle. It's like literally this big. It's kind of holding it with both hands.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the, and we were talking about wine moms.
Complexity versus simplicity.
Right. Well, so, you know, I don't know, it's almost, it's a little maddening how, you know, this notion is like you wasted all this energy. Like, how could you, how dare you, on trying to reach out to these shitty white women who were never, ever, ever going to
You mean
to
the
vote.
the one shitty white
the
woman,
one,
because
yeah.
There's just the one woman.
But you know, right. And so when a white woman voted for Trump, it's because that's just what white ladies do. You know, they just, mm-hmm. they align themselves with white supremacy because that's what they like and they're a monolith. When a person of color, as you said, who may be a man, so we mm-hmm. have to be much more serious about it, votes for Trump. It's because, I mean, in this article, it's because they were not adequately focused on by the campaign. You know, they were taken too much for granted. And, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. It's, I mean, but yeah, the basic summary is this group has complexity. This group is composed of individuals. Mm-hmm. This other group is not. They're just a monolith of badness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it seems like there are all sorts of new but old ways of calling women idiots, and they just keep sort of cropping up. So also, I was going to say, for the template article that one writes in one sleep, complicity mm-hmm. needs to be in there.
Yes. Yeah.
Because white women couldn't possibly like just be actively bad actors. It has to be complicity with the people who are actually doing things, aka white men. But white women
yes.
don't have much going on, but are complicit.
Yeah.
And so, actually, there's just one white woman. She's Ivanka Trump. So I'm just going to big reveal for our final blogging heads. I personally am Ivanka Trump.
As am I.
Mm-hmm.
This is our I am Sparta.
What a coincidence. I think I am
Ivanka.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh gosh. There was something that I
Oh hi Jared. Sorry, I couldn't help.
Oh,
what if we go off this silliness? Oh, sometimes it gets, but yeah, so this was just like, this article was like infuriating to me, both in its sort of predictable, churned out quality. And also just like, what is the point? Like, I guess I just don't really understand the point, because there are different white women who, you know, have different politics for, you know, because people are members of different, you know, subcategories as well as individuals. But like, I guess something I've been, I don't even want to say struggling with, something I've been sort of noticing since all of the 2016 exit poll rhetoric is I'm thinking like, I am a New York Jew. Where is this, like, where am I meeting all the white women who voted for Trump and like sitting with them and explaining to them, no, that's not how we white ladies do this. It doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't make any sense. Just like
yes.
logistically that there would be some sort of paths of communication open between the, you know, millions of people we're talking about here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've always enjoyed the insinuation that we're supposed to somehow approach fellow white women on the basis of race and say, you know,
and gender, and
from
gender.
White from one white woman to another, you know, as though, I mean, like, I think it kind of goes without saying, I don't know. I mean, the people who recommend doing this, I wonder if they've ever actually tried to have a conversation like that. But also, I mean, imagine somebody approaching you on that basis and saying, look, you know, as white women, really, you need to think about, you know, like racial solidarity. I mean, where that conversation would almost certainly go.
Yeah.
And so, you know, having now, you know, been convinced to vote my white womanhood, I've decided to vote for Nazi McBoatface.
I mean, there's just, I guess what I find about this is also just the amount of times this article is written by a white woman. And I say this article, there may not be actually just one white woman, but I think there might just be one white lady's article. does seem possible with a few tweaks here and there. And it's just like, obviously, if you're writing that article, you don't think that you are yourself a Trump voter. You know, there are exceptions.
Speaking of performative, I mean, the women who write these articles, even as they indict all white women, invariably the act of writing the article serves to distance them from those white women, even though they are at the same time asserting that white women are a monolith. And actually, this just, I don't know, I want to just like say this because it's something that bothers me, and I feel like it never actually gets explicitly said when people have conversations about this stuff.
Go to it.
If white women actually did vote as a monolith, and if, like, as is asserted in this article, white women vote for Trump, white women vote Republican, if that were actually true, then Trump would be the next, I mean, he would be in the White House again. Like, you know, if white women actually voted as a block in the way that it's constantly implied that they do, and if they all voted Republican as a block, we would never have another Democratic president or politician in office ever, ever again. And actually, this, you know, the same thing.
This is too logical. I don't think that that's allowed.
I mean, it's so goddamn obvious that it should go without saying, and yet, you know, the way that people talk about this, it's as though it literally doesn't happen. It's as though we don't actually rely on both white women and white men, for that matter, to elect Democratic politicians to office. If all of the white men defected to voting Republican en masse, we also would never, ever have another Democratic politician in office ever, ever again.
This is a thing that does get ignored. I guess what I wish, if I could, like, you know, actually tweak the discourse, which, you know, here I am trying, but I don't know. I guess I would just say, like, to just get rid of the idea that all women are saints and generous and selfless and, you know, kind, and the idea that all white women are personally Ivanka Trump. And why not just, like, people are people and have that as, like, kind of the main, I don't know. I know that's a tired way of thinking about things, but you can look at things in a sort of broad demographic way, but then you're left with, like, if you find that one category voted like 51% for somebody, then it's like somehow, like, the logic of elections and democracy becomes like as if the votes of all the remaining 49% would be, like, switched over somehow. You know what I mean? Like, this way where if it's roughly 50-50, it's like the whole thing of, like, if you're having some conversation with a sophisticated European and they're like, why do Americans all like Trump? Tell me, American, why do you like Trump so much? And you have to be like, well, you know, like, half the country doesn't, you know. Anyway.
Yeah.
I've had such conversations in my life.
Oh, man. I was successfully, like, guilted into letting a lady in Marrakesh give me, like, non-consensual henna all over my hand because she mentioned Trump and she threw me so off balance by mentioning it. And I was, like, so apologetic. I was like, I'm so sorry for him. And meanwhile, she's, like, busy hennaing my hand. And I was like, wait, what are you doing? And then it was too late. So I was,
that's a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. This is my guilt, my American guilt over our bad president, you know, caused me to be marked for two damn weeks. It took a long time for that stuff to fade away.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I forgot about that. I was so embarrassed about that. This was a couple of years ago that I never told anybody about it. I feel like there was one other thing. Oh yeah. We were talking about if we could tweak the discourse. Mm-hmm. So this is where I want to just say that I had really hoped in the wake of a Joe Biden victory that maybe the left, particularly like the very online discourse driving left, would just step back a little bit from what has become like an incredibly casual, almost reflexive form of race essentialism and gender essentialism, and it's like the ugh white men progressivism, where people just sort of very automatically disparage somebody based on their membership in these identity categories that they didn't.
When you said ugh, you meant the boots.
Ugh UGH.
And I was thinking like the basic men.
Yeah, no, I mean, do men wear Uggs? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it goes either way. It could be UGG, you know, UGG, UGG. It could be UGG, UGG, like the camp counselor on Slew Your Shorts.
I don't know this.
Oh, well, I'll
have to look.
I don't want to talk about it. Okay. It's a 90s Nickelodeon show that, you know, I think that had a little bit of a cult following. But anyway, yeah, I'd hoped that this would maybe kind of stop, that maybe people would realize that it was a, you know, a dumb road to go down, because it is so dumb. This, you know, I mean, on top of being distasteful, and it is that too, it's just so unintelligent to lump people together in this way. And you know, the fact is that race and sex are not even meaningful demographic categories for analyzing, you know, anything like this, you know, especially voting patterns. You know, the fact is, if you want to split people up in a way that tells you something about who they are and how they vote, you'd be much better off, you know, analyzing things like, you know, do they live in an urban versus a rural area? And even then, you know, it's still going to be an oversimplification. But race and gender, especially in particular, are oversimplifications.
I mean, I think it's fine to look at, if you're going to look at all the demographic things, it would be weird to not have race and gender in there. But I also think, I just wish there could be a way of talking about, maybe this is just too naive of me, that didn't end up being like, you random white woman are personally responsible for a bunch of white women you don't even know voting for Trump.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is
control, you know, over it.
It draws a line that does not actually exist between, you know, your categories that you're born into because you have a certain color of skin, or, you know, a certain ethnic extraction, and or, you know, certain equipment between your legs, that, you know, it draws a line between this and so you must think a certain way. And I mean, particularly with race, that's just, that literally is not a thing.
I think this might be a segue to our next topic, unless you have more.
I don't think so.
So this is kind of like, the next topic is kind of, this is just a pretty natural part two. So there was this viral tweet, okay? All good things begin with a viral tweet, don't they? Isn't that's how the origin of the universe, a viral tweet.
Yes, that's right. God, you know, God tweeted for 7 days and then he rested and saw it was bad. I think that's what the Bible says.
I agree with you. That well cited, very accurate citation of the Bible there. Okay, so Catherine Morgan tweeted the following, okay? I believe she is a writer and bookseller. I need to actually move. No, I think that's what I had noted, but then
right. But I mean, she works in customer service at a bookstore. I think we might want to note that she's, I think, quite young, like early to mid 20s.
Okay, that's okay. Are her editors, however, because I feel like this. So this story is going to be kind of a publishing story in a way. Okay,
it is. Yeah,
because it's as much about the articles themselves and their, yeah, somewhat frustrating qualities as it is about what it means that they appeared. So the tweet that launched all those takes and so forth. Okay, ready? Again, I'm quoting a tweet. This is not my tweet. This is not me just speaking. This is a quotation. Ready? I did not spend my summer processing orders of anti-racism books for white women for 55% of them to still vote for this piece of shit man. This performative act means nothing to me. Okay. So that is the tweet that got a lot of people, and that was sort of like then set forth, like, editors, take a look at this, you know, and clearly like the hope was to turn this into published articles, and it is now at least 2 published articles.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice deal to have, you know, to have one idea and basically write one piece and get it published twice.
Well, so I think, so there are 2 pieces that came out of this, one of which is like a little bit more substantive than the other, although both of which, because of what Katja said, that they are kind of the same article, come up against some of the same problems. So the first and more sort of, I'm going to just say easily dismissed one, was in Bitch magazine, which is a publication that has reasonable things in it as well. It's not, you know, like, if you don't know, you might think like, what is Bitch magazine? It's where people bitch. But like, it's a feminist, you know, publication.
Slur. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I'm sorry, but like in an age when Vogue thinks it's like reclaiming everything, you know, thinks it's all whatever progressive, yeah, at least Bitch magazine was never first. Pretending to be Bitch magazine was never, it's not atoning for something. It just is. Okay.
Right.
So this article was called White Rage, White Guilt. How long do we wait for white women to learn? ? And okay, so there's a particular quote from this article that I think pretty much like drives home the issue. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's pretty short, but it gets to the problem.
Do it.
Okay. And yet, despite all of the learning that supposedly took place via these books, it's these anti-racist books, okay, in early November 2020, exit polls stated that among white women, Trump still held their support. An estimated 55% of white women voted for Trump. Okay. End quote. Now, where is, okay, all of you amateur and perhaps professional logicians in our audience, where is the flaw in this line of thinking?
Is it perhaps a logician, so I can't.
Well, nor am I, and I'm going to just have to say all the same that I think the issue here could be that there is zero evidence in this article that there is even so much as one white woman who both bought an anti-racism book / tried to and complained when it was out of stock and also voted for Trump. For all we know from this article, this is a thing that has never happened. Now, I'm just going to say probably it's happened. We're talking millions of people here, but I mean, like, there needs to be the evidence that these are the same people, and this article lacks the evidence that these are the same white women. And I feel like that's really what the article kind of is like centered around as that's its central fact. And it's a very shaky one on account of having no evidence.
Yes. I mean, this is on top of the fact that, I mean, and this was a problem with the Liz Lenz article as well. The exit polls, particularly this year, particularly in, you know, in a year when most people and especially most Democrats voted by mail, they're basically garbage. You know, you can't draw any kind of a meaningful conclusion from what people told you on their way out of their polling place, which, you know, you're going to find that people who voted in person overwhelmingly voted Republican. And, you know, that's because, well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons.
Nobody asked me when I was leaving the pharmacy where I mailed in my ballot for Biden here in Toronto. Nobody was like, Phoebe, who did you vote for? Offering me the opportunity to give a performative Joe Biden, of course.
Yes, because I'm, you know, because I'm not a racist. But, you know, and you could brandish your copy of White Fragility.
Which I, of course, had.
In lieu of a ballot, I just scribbled Joe Biden's name on a page that I'd torn out of the White Fragility, like, workbook. And I'm sure
that counts as like 20 votes.
Right? Yeah, it counts.
Oh, 20, it counts extra.
20 to 30,000 votes, I think.
At least. It's true that the exit polls are, you know, shaky evidence at best. But even if they were 100% accurate, like to the T, whatever, there is no reason to think these are the same white women. You know, the ones who are buying White Fragility, looking for White Fragility, doing the anti-racist Instagram, and the ones who are voting for Trump, you're talking about such huge numbers of people here that there's absolutely no sort of anecdotal even reason to conclude these are the same people. And I guess it seems to keeping the same argument that floats around, which we've, I believe, talked about on the podcast. It's definitely been in the Feminine Chaos newsletter. It's definitely been on our Twitters. But basically, like, being performative and kind of like shallow in your anti-racist activism is not the same as like being a Trump voter. I don't mean that one is this way and one is that. These are just two different things, both of which might annoy somebody, but that doesn't mean that these are the same people.
Yeah. Okay. You know? So two things about this. Number one, the fact that this article, I guess that it was the Lit Hub article which was the more substantive, mm-hmm. also by Catherine Morgan. But you had mentioned the quote from it earlier, that this article is, you know, extensively laments the fact that these women, bought this book performatively.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's the book. Sorry. That's the article, Catherine Morgan's article about that wave of anti-racist bestsellers over the summer, ..
Right.
Catherine Morgan on book selling to white, quote, allies.
Yeah. So like there's this extensive, I mean, it's not just lamentation. It's actually mockery, you know, like directly of like, oh, like look at these jerk women thinking that it's enough to buy white fragility. I find that very frustrating, like one of the more frustrating aspects of this article because, okay, granted, if you have the choice between performative activism versus sincere activism, then sure, of course, you want the sincere version. That said, this was the summer where silence is violence trended like repeatedly. You know, not performing your activism was basically not an option. If you didn't post your black square or whatever, even if you preferred to do your activism in private, you know,
What's private?
I mean, does that exist? You know, somewhere not online, somewhere not on social media, you were told that you were basically complicit because you were being silent, and there, you know, being silent, like you might as well just go to a KKK meeting, you know, racist condoner. So, you know, to basically demand performance and then mm-hmm. to ding women for doing what they were told they had to do at the
women, okay. Yes.
Yeah, women particularly mm-hmm. at the risk of suffering like this social death for not being good enough allies. Like that's just you play stupid games, you get stupid prizes, I guess. But the other thing is that after thinking about this for a while, I actually think that there probably are more women out there who did in fact buy and read White Fragility and also voted for Trump.
Don't you wish they had been located though and interviewed something? Because wouldn't that have been much more interesting than this kind of gesturing?
It would have been because, and this is the thing, I think that, you know, what this reveals is not that actually that white women are all, you know, shitty performative activists who don't really mean what they say when they say that they're against racism. I think it reveals something complex and uncomfortable about the fact that being against racism, and particularly against the sort of the type of racism, you know, the police, police discrimination, police brutality that triggered all of the outcry this summer, doesn't necessarily correlate with voting a particular way. People were reading White Fragility as part of church book groups. I'm sure that many of the people who read the book in that context and who even agreed with it, nevertheless went on to vote for Trump because they don't see a vote for him as a vote for racism or whatever else. It's just, you know, basically that people are more complicated.
Unless they're women.
And then
they're very, very simple.
Right. And then there's just the one.
So this is what I think we need to like explicitly address about both of these articles, is this emphasis on specifically, it's not that white people, you know, bought these books and also demographically, if not the exact same people, although probably whatever, some did voted for Trump. The issue is, why is it white women? Why are white women specifically highlighted here, given that by all accounts, it was more white men voting for Trump? Why are white women coming up in this context? Well, so now this is from the Bitch article. Where was this? Okay. As I scrolled through Facebook, I began to passively take note of the kind of person who was sharing these sort of embrace your differences messages. Interesting enough, these people were all white. More specifically, they were white women. So this does not seem like, why white women? What does this mean? And I think I have a couple theories about why this whole story became about white women. One is that, you know, it's this sort of publishing thing and who's buying books in general and who's posting a lot on Instagram. Maybe that's more women. Okay, that's one theory. Another is that it's, and this gets to the title of our show, Cat's Brilliant Coinage, the Madonna Karen Complex. Karen. These articles are about Karen calling the manager because where are my anti-racism books? Come on. Get me those anti-racism books. Because that's what this is plugging into, right? That's the sort of, that's the pre-existing framework into which a reader is meant to be setting this story. And I bet this totally did happen because, and there are, and this is why I think the LitHub article is the stronger of the two, because it does, you know, quote from different booksellers. It does sound like there were people who were upset about not getting their books. Now, the question is this whole sort of Karen as villainous consumer cliche all that helpful in the world? I don't know. Because like, so this is how the LitHub article begins, okay? It begins, during the summer of 2020, I spent countless hours helping irate customers cancel their orders of popular anti-racism books. Before I opened a new email, I'd say a quick prayer that the content of the message wouldn't make me cry. And then wait for the next sentence, okay? For the most part, customers were simply asking me why their order hadn't shipped yet. Now, I would think you would not cry because you wanted to know, because somebody wanted to know why their order hadn't shipped yet. I'm sure it's annoying to be on the receiving end. Like, I've been on the receiving end of, like, why aren't my grades in, or, you know, like, why aren't my edits in, whatever, you know, but I'm sure on the scale, this would be annoying, you know, right. Like, why hasn't my order shipped yet?
Of course, if you work in customer service, it is also your job.
Yeah, so that's the thing, like, is it, so there, I think that something emerged with the shift from just sort of white ladies discourse of the 2016 era to the sort of Karen, which is all this make me think of a very interesting Wesley Yang tweet about, you know, how difficult it is to think about, like, 2016 without Karen discourse, because like that's new, mm-hmm. right? But I think there is this idea that anybody who wants any sort of like customer service help at this time is inherently in the wrong. So it's not about the customer is always right. It's not about the customer sometimes right. It's the customer is always wrong. On account of being a consumer, how dare you consume at a time like this? And the people who are the consumers are, of course, women with the unacceptable haircut, white women, but white women of a certain age who are not to anybody's sexual interests anyway. So I think that's what this is plugging into, this Karen calling the manager sort of situation.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also into the notion of women as sort of materialistic, you know, mm-hmm. even in the pandemic, even in the midst of the protesting, bitches be shopping.
Mm-hmm. Shopping for these and putting it on Instagram, doing a selfie. And yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of it. And I guess there were in the LitHub article, I guess it was a few quotes or there was something about, let me try to find where this was. Sorry. Okay. So this was a quote. This is Catherine Morgan quoting a different bookseller. Okay. When I asked Mullen what's the worst thing she had to deal with this summer, she told me how some customers made racist comments about the frustrating state of back orders by saying, "This is exactly why I don't support Black businesses," or "I went out of my way to patronize your Black business and you can't even get a simple thing right." So I guess
I am so curious as to how many people actually said that verbatim.
I'm sure it exists in the world.
I'm sure it does. I'm trying to envision, you know, the person who actually does care enough about this stuff, you know, to want to specifically support Black business owners, but then who says literally, I went out of my way to patronize your Black business. I mean, it just sounds so like obscenely over the top racist.
Okay. So I have a few thoughts about this, and it's kind of tangential, but I think kind of gets us there, which is, what does it mean to buy a book? We're going to have to like step back and be a little abstract here, but what does it mean? First of all, people buy books for other people. It could be that you had to buy this book for your book group, for your workplace, whatever, and that the person placing the order is not a true believer in Robin DiAngelo or whatever, but was instructed by somebody else to buy this book, right? You know, or somebody requested it as a gift. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that the individual buying that book is the one who even wants to read it / Instagram it. Okay, so that's one issue. Another is, does it mean that you agree with it, the fact that you are buying a book? Does it mean that you buy into everything in it? Does it mean you have every intention of reading it? Does it mean, like, normally there's no expectation that to buy a book means anything particular. But here, and I think this really came through in both of these articles, it's sort of like, how could people buy this book and, for example, not pick it up from the bookstore, or, you know, not keep it forever and ever, not fill out any associated worksheets, where it's like with any book, once it's bought, who knows, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, so, I think that that's a good point. I mean, I had also posited the existence, although I'm sure that there are fewer of these people out there than of the ones who were always going to vote for Trump, but who also, you know, are against racism, and they just don't see any particular tension between these two things. But I'm sure that there is also a woman out there who bought White Fragility and read it and was like, this is awful. Like, I'm, you know, it was, you know, sent into the arms of the right because the book was just so bad.
Would you read that personal essay? Because I would. The one that's like, I read White Fragility and now I'm writing for the Federalist about.
You know, it's so funny. Like, I mean, one of the most interesting things about this year, and I mean, White Fragility, it was one of the first things we ever talked about on this podcast.
It was, it's very full circle.
Back in like 2018. And at the time we were early skeptics about White Fragility. And I remember being told at the time that being skeptical about this book meant that I was exactly the type of white person who really needed to read it and internalize its messages the most. Screw that. But, you know, over the course of this year, and especially as it's sort of come out that Robin DiAngelo pulls in, you know, absolutely enormous amounts of money.
Robin DiAngelo, who is white.
Who is white,
Let us remind.
You know, pulls in more money for her speaking fees than, you know, comparable authors of color. In some cases, I think it's been alleged that she actually was like collaborating with a woman of color to do these speaking engagements, but she was taking the lion's share of the proceeds. But yeah, you know, just seeing how people have sort of begun to about face on White Fragility has mm-hmm. been a rewarding, frankly, aspect of 2020, you know, a year with so few other bright spots in it. But, you know, what's interesting too, you were mentioning that like when a person buys a book, it's not necessarily because they themselves intend to read it, or because they themselves intend to read it and immediately agree with everything that it says. I saw, as you know, we are kind of rounding out into the holiday season here, somebody, had written an article suggesting that people buy White Fragility for like their less woke, less enlightened friends as a pointed gift. It's like, this is like the, you know, buying the vacuum cleaner for your wife, except you're, you know, buying White Fragility.
But maybe she should have the vacuum cleaner to vacuum in atoning for being, if she is white, a white woman.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I know we could even segue from here into yet another discussion about whether it's a feminist act to allow somebody to clean your house or whether, you know, you have to do the whole thing yourself.
It's definitely the more hard labor you do at home, the more you scrub things, the more feminist.
Right. Yes. Yeah. The act of scrubbing actually exercises the feminist muscle, which is located in your forearm. That's science.
I'm really holding back thoughts here. I cannot share.
What else do you use your forearm muscles for? Yeah.
Okay. I am just going to say that you can also find us on Patreon for a slightly sillier version of our podcast. Yeah. I mean, I guess the whole thing with performative, like, it is annoying, right? Like, the progressive performative thing is annoying, but it's not necessarily sort of malicious, and I just think there's also this question of how do you know what's performative when you can't read people's minds? That's another thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's the whole question of that I just want to, before we wrap up this topic, just this question of what it means that these articles, neither of which provided any sort of useful information, and which the Bitch magazine one really just like basically was centered around an undemonstrated fact of the same white women did this and then did that. Well, who knows if that's the case. What does it mean that these articles appeared?
I mean, I would say quite cynically that it's an act in and of itself of performative allyship on the part of the editors who published them. That they,
I mean,
decided...
if anything is, I don't know. Cause it just seems like the sort of thing where like, because I've seen people sort of positively sharing these articles. That's actually how I found them and how they ended up in my timeline. People are like, look, isn't this great? And it's like, I guess what I wish the articles had been, or at least the LitHub one, which I have a bit more sympathy towards, I wish that had been about people throwing fits, like with actual, like with some more data about people throwing fits, and without this emphasis on it specifically having to be women, unless it happened to be women, but without it being this kind of preconceived idea of that might have been interesting. But then again, I fall back to this issue of like the bad consumer as sort of like the villain of our times, when like all people can do and have been able to do for like nearly, it's like starting to feel like it's been a year now or whatever, you know, for a really long time, all you can do is stay home and order stuff on the internet, yeah. You know, including if your job involves going outside when you need to consume things, which we all eventually will, you know, everybody needs to consume stuff. Sometimes you're supposed to be ordering stuff on the internet. And the idea that like the source of all evil is the person who's sitting, clicking to see when their order is arriving. I mean, that's all there is to do anymore. You know?
That's true.
Yeah. And I find it hard to believe that even people selling things are not themselves also sometimes buying things.
That is also a good point.
But I think I may have said all I could about this, but we really, do you have more on this?
No, I think you've basically summed it up. And I feel like I talked a lot actually during this one. So.
Oh, so I feel like I did as well, but you know what? That's feminine chaos for you.
It is. So thank you so much for joining us here on Blogging Heads.
Yeah. And thank you, Blogging Heads as well.
Yes. We love you, Blogging Heads. And especially Aria Cohen Aid, our producer, did a really good job. Thanks.
All right. Yes.
Special
yes.
Shout out to you. Okay. So yeah, you can find us moving forward, on patreon.com/feminine chaos. You know, if you want to subscribe, if you just want to keep listening to our free episodes, we're going to be releasing them more frequently than we have been on Blogging Heads. Because you know, it turns out when you record audio, you don't have to put lipstick on. Mm-hmm. Or look presentable or even wear clothes. So, mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It's a little easier. If you already subscribed to our feed on Blogging Heads and listened to it via your local podcast provider, you will automatically be kicked over to our new location. And we are distributing the podcast right now via Acast. So if you want to find it on there, you can go to acast.com and search for Heaven and Chaos. I think that's it. I think I've said everything that there was to say.
I think so. I think we're good.
Okay.
This has been Femme in Chaos. Thanks
for
joining
us. Bye.
Bye.